We're discussing the presidential transition here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could join us. The Senate started confirmation hearings Tuesday for top national security posts in the Biden administration. It is the first step of the confirmation process. Last month, the nonpartisan Center for Presidential Transition at the Partnership for Public Service, it outlined the resources that job seekers can have looking to fill the roughly 4,000 politically appointed jobs in the administration. What do you think about the cabinet picks so far? What do you want to know about how the plum book works and that lists both filled and vacant positions in the administration? 800-642-1234. Max Steyer is president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. Max, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
What does it mean for our nation to have a smooth transition between administrations? What's at stake?
So the best way to answer that question is to talk about what does our government do? And fundamentally, it's our most important tool for addressing our biggest problems as a society, and the only one that has the imprimatur of the public and taxpayer resources behind it. So the transition is simply about how we ensure that as part of our democratic process, the new leadership team that's going to comes in able and ready to run that government and address those problems. And that's what fundamentally we're talking about here. It's the takeover of the largest, most complex and important organization, not only probably in the world today, but in history. And it's a big deal and it's a tough job. And so transitioning right means you're going to be able to govern well and solve big problems.
Yeah, largest, most complex, also in a raging pandemic, in an economy that's barely limping along, and, you know, other stresses. So how do you make this smooth amid a crisis?
So, yeah, your list is a good start. And as you suggest, there's so much more, you know, largest cyber attack that we've ever experienced. The government itself has a lot of challenges, low morale from a beaten down workforce, attrition in that workforce. I mean, there's a lot of challenge going on right now. And the way you make it smooth is you start early. So the first and recognition that you have to have is it's such a big task that if you wait until you know you're going to be president, it's too late. And thankfully, the Biden team started in spring of last year. They had former Senator Ted Kaufman and Jeff Zients run the effort, and they've done the best job of preparing that any other team has ever done. So the first piece is start early. The second is have the right goals. So you need to make sure you're going to be ready to get your team in place. You know that how you're going to convert your campaign promises into to action and governance. And you understand what the circumstances are on the ground. So it's a very, very big, complicated task. For me, the best metaphor is sort of to think about the universe pre-Big Bang. The transition preparation is sort of setting up a government in waiting. And then, today, Inauguration Day, you're on second one at noon, and you own the whole thing, which is a large, complex operation.
Yeah, more so than just here are the keys. I mean, it is massive. You also have to surround yourself early on with the people who share your vision, because you made all of these campaign promises and now you have to really deliver, and people are going to be impatient. They want it now in those first 100 days.
Yes, and you're entirely right. The one thing I would add to that is that most people think about the president coming in with their team. The most important part of the president's team is already there, and that's the career civil servants who are extraordinary and who have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution. There are about 2 million of them. Know that that's the same number as it was in the late 1960s, so that number hasn't grown. So one of the challenges often is a new political team comes in and they think that they can recreate a command and control system with the people they bring rather than, fully engaging the people that are already there. And those are the people who actually know, what's going on. They've got incredible expertise, and they're vital to moving anything forward. So, the truth is that it's important for the president to get, in this instance, his leadership team confirmed for the Senate-confirmed positions and in place for those that are not Senate-confirmed. But the more important part of what he, President Biden, will need to do is to engage and support that career workforce.
Yeah, so the career civil servants have that institutional knowledge and the knowledge of the past 4 years in order to assist the new administration.
Yeah, and this is maybe better to put a face on that, because it's easy to say career civil servants, whatever. The face I'd put on that is Tony Fauci. He is a poster child of the career civil service, somebody who is extraordinarily talented and committed to the government. He's been doing this for, you know, 4 decades, and there's just no one better. So, you know, as important as it is for Joe Biden to get his political appointees in place, even more important that the Tony Faucis, and there are many like him across government, are engaged and, made part of the team, because they are fundamentally the deeper set of expertise, and it's the engine room. I mean, the reality is that there are 2 million civil servants and 4,000 political appointees. The political appointees, the best thing they can do is actually help remove barriers for the career workforce to get the job done.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Max Dyer, president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, houses the Center for Presidential Transition, which we're talking about. What questions do you have about the transition process, how it works? Have you been watching who Biden is picking for his cabinet? What do you think? 800-642-1234 to join in. Max, in November, after the election and Biden's clear victory, we came to know this word ascertainment, and the delay in ascertainment meant that Biden's team was locked out from government data, could not, you know, make contact with federal agencies, couldn't get the millions of dollars in transition money. Was that a setback after all?
So it was, and the reason why it was not as bad as it could have been is what we just talked about, the fact that the Biden team had been very active, you know, starting in the springtime of 2020 and preparing. And they also have had a lot of people involved in the transition preparation who were very familiar with government. And, you know, a fair number of those faces are showing up again, either in the cabinet or, you know, more likely in some of the non-Senate confirmed positions. But there's no doubt, and you really focused on the important issues there, which is, you know, after the election, the standard, you know, responses for the incumbent administration to enable the transition to have access to the agencies. And why that's important is you need to know what's happening now on the ground, real-time information. So, again, to give this sort of a face, think about the vaccine rollout. The Biden team now owns it. They're responsible. They've made a commitment of getting, you know, 100 million vaccines in the first 100 days out into people's arms. And they're making this commitment with, limited knowledge. They actually did not get access to all the information about what's happening right now. What are the plans? What are the issues that people inside government know we're going to have to confront? So it's really quite, you know, it's, again, another metaphor, which would be sort of the relay race. You can't afford to have the runner stop and then hand it off to the next runner. Instead, they have to be running side by side at full speed to make sure you don't lose any time.
Smooth handoff,
and that's what you need here. And so, you know, that's really what the Biden team, you know, has to deal with. And then, as you've said earlier, it's, you know, the pandemic is surely front and center, but it's not only the pandemic. It's the economic consequences. It's the national security issues. It's, you know, the list is huge and diverse. So that has to be going on across the board, and having experienced people mean a lot. The ascertainment delay, it's what it did is it slows things down that you didn't want to slow down, and it creates more risk. And the consequence ultimately is people die. Our government is about keeping us safe, and getting the vaccine out faster means that more people are safe. There's a lot at stake here, and you know, sometimes, you know, words, as you said, like ascertainment are kind of bizarre words that no one really understands. But it boils down to, you know, giving people the information they need to be able to understand what they need to do to run the government. And that's vital.
Max Dyer, he leads the Partnership for Public Service. It's a nonprofit focused on improving the way government works. What questions do you have about how transitions work? What Senate confirmation will you watch and why? Biden promised a diverse cabinet. Do you think he's accomplished that with his picks? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Max Dyer on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the Biden administration transition here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Journalists have been reporting on what's called burrowing in government jobs. In this case, Trump appointees moving into powerful career civil service roles inside the government with job protections that would make it difficult for Biden to remove them. What do you want to know about the history of burrowing and the status of these so-called conversions? Do you think hiring in the federal government is open, fair, and based on the criteria for the job? 800-642-1234 to join in. Max Dyer leads the Partnership for Public Service that houses the Center for Presidential Transition. He's with us for the hour. Max, what are your thoughts on this idea of burrowing, or how you see people converting into other jobs, something regulated by the Office of Personnel Management?
So, it's worth taking one step back and saying, why do we have the system we have today, which is that most employees need to be selected on the basis of merit? And interestingly, it goes back to the assassination of a president in 1883, and President Garfield was assassinated by a would-be and unhappy job seeker, and the norms there were jobs were all part of the spoil system. If you were on the winning side, you got to hand out the goodies of jobs in the federal government. And as a result of that assassination, a people's movement that had been pretty strong got new fuel, and there was a law passed called the Pendleton Act, which moved the federal government away from the spoil system and to a modern, merit-based approach to giving jobs in government. And it's the, foundation of, frankly, our success, ultimately as a nation, by having an effective government, was the idea that, these jobs really were for people who were dedicated to the public good and had the best skills possible to serve the public. And, there's been a struggle over time as to whether or not that would be the norm or whether we could return back to the spoil system. And so we spoke earlier about 4,000 political appointees. People just accept it because that's what we have. It's more than any other democracy that I'm aware of in the world by a lot. And it wasn't always that way. I mean, in 1960, I think there were about 1,000 political appointees. So truth is, we don't need 4,000 political appointees, and the last thing we need is more than 4,000 political appointees. And so burrowing is really an assault on this notion that the people who are best able to serve the public should have the job serving the public, and it's a problem. It's a problem, I think, coming out of this administration in a way that it hasn't been as serious a problem before. So every change in presidency, there's a flag raised about burrowing political appointees who are placed into career positions so that they have jobs after the administration, after when they're supposed to be gone. And by and large, there have been small numbers of folk that have had that conversion occur. In this instance, with this administration, I have a lot, larger worries about it. And my statement here is by no means a partisan one. It's a factual one. There are all kinds of instances in which we can see that people are being placed in jobs where they clearly have no business being there. And one of the more prominent ones is someone from the White House counsel's office. Mr. Ellis was put in a position at the National Security Administration, as the general counsel, which is a career position. He's a relatively junior lawyer running a massive general counsel's office and having so-called beat out in a competition, people who have had huge amounts of experience in the national security arena, which he has not. And there was a call from the White House there saying, we want him. So clear, in my view, violation of the rules of hiring in the government. So we know that there have been improper examples of burrowing already. We don't know how many because there's not a lot of transparency around this. You mentioned the Office of Personnel Management is supposed to be the referee on this, and I think there are real questions whether, again, under the outgoing administration, it's been a true referee at all. You know, the Biden team has, in addition to all the issues you've talked about, they're also going to have to do a lot of repair in the government, and this will be a consequential question, which is, you know, identifying people who are improperly put in jobs to make sure that the system is operating as it should and that people are there because they're the best qualified and they're there to serve the public.
We're talking with Max Dyer, president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. It's a nonpartisan group that houses a Center for Presidential Transition. We're looking closely at what a transition entails with your insights and your questions. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jimmy now, joining us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy. What is on your mind
Morning.
About the transition? Hi.
Well, I was worked in the government for 30 years, and I'm pretty sure there's a trial period for any new employee that hasn't been working for the government before. And I was wondering if these burrowing in positions would be subject to that trial period where basically you can separate them with little or no cause. And my other question was, how long do you think it'll take for Biden to clean up OPM and FLRA and some of these other boards that that adjudicate federal employee complaints?
Jimmy, thank you. Jimmy, wondering, is there a probationary period first, Max?
So first off, Jimmy, thank you for your service. That, you know, we benefited as a society from the commitment you had to the public, and that's fantastic. And you're 100% right. There is a probation period in the federal government, typically of a year, and that should enable the Biden team relatively easily to remove people that are inappropriately in jobs. And frankly, even if you didn't have that probationary period, if they're there inappropriately, they can be removed. It just requires work and time and effort, as you know, amidst everything else that needs to take place. You also asked another really important, well, a couple of important questions, which is how long will it take the Biden team to clean up the mess? And then also, you know, how do they deal with some of the agencies that deal with workforce issues in the government? You mentioned the FLRA. One that I think is particularly important is the Merit Systems Protection Board. And I mentioned earlier the commitment in the federal government to what are called the merit principles, ensuring that really only the best qualified are in jobs and that they are not hampered by, you know, partisan choices or direction. And one of the most important organizations in the government to protect the merit system is this Merit Systems Protection Board. Under the Trump administration, they've never had a quorum. And what that means is that then-President Trump had simply not actually nominated and got confirmed the members of the board. So there are literally thousands of cases that are just sitting there. That means thousands of people who've not had, in effect, their day in court to ensure that their rights were protected. And it's an example of, you know, the sand that was poured into the machine by the Trump administration that has really bad consequence. And it will take, in my view, probably years to be able to clean all that up. And at the same time, it's not only about cleaning up the problems that President Trump created. It's also about modernizing our government in ways that have, you know, fallen behind because the world is changing. So.
Yeah.
I think the Biden team has to rebuild the government back better, and they have a big task ahead of them.
Can you explain for us what the plumb book is and how it is used?
Yep, absolutely. And again, this is an example of something that needs to be modernized in government. The actual title is the United States Government Policy and
Supporting
Position.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There you go, exactly. And it largely has some other jobs, but it's largely the jobs that are the political appointments, so the jobs that the President of the United States or his political appointees can determine who goes into those positions. So it's become a little the directory for most people about what are those jobs that they may want to pursue that are political. And it's put out only once every 4 years. So again, this is a little bit like, you know, for those that are old enough, you know, the yellow pages of the 1980s. and again, just a great example where government needs to be modernized. You know, we should have a real-time directory of these jobs. They're really important jobs, and there's no requirement on an administration to say who's in them, but for once every 4 years, and it's at their end of their administration. So by the time this thing comes out, it's already out of date. So you're really getting a historical snapshot of what the Trump team looked like in June of last year. So, you know, it really becomes useful only for those people who are trying to figure out, like, what jobs they want to pursue in government on the political level. And, you know, we've supported legislation.
And we have to, Max, we have to pause right here as we talk with the CEO of the Partnership for Public Service and its work. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Max Steyer and the transition, taking your questions after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the presidential transition on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Biden's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told NBC News this week, all of this work behind the scenes of hiring people, interviewing people, getting policy processes ready, it's not as sexy, end quote. But organizations like the Partnership for Public Service would argue it's hugely critical work. What can be done to ensure an accountable, transparent, and smooth transition? What are you watching for out of the Biden-Harris administration in its first 100 days? Join in 800-642-1234. Max Steyer is CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, which houses the Center for Presidential Transition, and he's with us for the hour. Let's bring in Jess now in Milwaukee. Hi, Jess. What would you like to add?
Good morning. I don't understand why this guy is being looked at as negative, meaning this young person going into the position at the NSA. Just because he was appointed by Trump doesn't mean he's a mole. It could mean he's simply not politically corrupted by the system, and he might actually play by the rules that they're supposed to play by. Secondly, when you mentioned Build Back Better, that's not a term that was just used by Biden during the campaign. It was also used in foreign countries like Australia as their Build Back Better plan, as well as the World Economic Forum. So this is more of an agenda of a globalist issue than just something going on in our own country.
Jess, thank you. Let's, Max, first, number one, he brings up Michael Ellis's appointment as the National Security Agency's top lawyer, you know, that he has to prove himself on the job first.
Yeah, so listen, I think that I'm glad for the question because I think it helps demystify the hiring process in government. And so, you know, typically what you would see in a position like that one would be a competition in which the agency, in this instance, this is such a senior job, the agency leadership would design the job specifications, and then the agency would have an HR function that would run the search, which is what happened in this position. But what is unusual is not simply that a political appointee has been put in the job, but rather that the White House has directly intervened in the hiring process. So that's an immediate red flag. The point here is the basic one, which is if you want to make sure that the best person is hired rather than the person with the best connections, you need to make sure that outside, especially senior political figures, aren't putting not just their thumb but the full weight of their body on the scale. And so you're definitely right that it's possible for a political appointee to be one of those best qualified people, but plainly here the process has been corrupted. It wasn't a arm's length neutral decision making process in which people were looking at the qualifications and determining that he deserved them. It was the hammer from the White House saying you must hire this person. And we also know that this person, yes, a junior lawyer and possibly talented, was going up against people who were deeply knowledgeable about the national security arena, who had run large legal offices, neither of which he had done. So both on process and substance, it's clear from the face that this is not actually the hiring process that that should be enabled. And in fact, the leader of the NSA didn't want him. And the White House had to come back a second time and say, no, you must take him. There's no clear example I've ever seen of someone who has broken pretty much every rule in the book around hiring. So my own sense is that, you know, legitimate to say there could be political appointees who deserve these jobs. This is not one of them. And it's not the only instance in which we're aware of these things. And unfortunately, there's no transparency requirement. In my view, there should be one. So we don't know how many others are out there. You know, agencies are supposed to report to the Office of Personnel Management. They're supposed to report to Congress, but those things are not made public. But reporters have done a good job of uncovering many more such examples.
Max, let's step back for a moment and look at you. You run the Partnership for Public Service. What do you do? What does this partnership do?
Thank you. So we're a relatively small nonpartisan nonprofit organization. We started 20 years ago, and our goal is to help the government work better. And you think about the world out there of nonprofits, it's amazing. There are 1.5 million of them doing all kinds of important things, from national security to poverty, immigration, any issue of public concern, there are a whole slew of nonprofits working on them. And our perspective is that the 800-pound gorilla, the entity that has the most impact in all those areas, is actually our government. And therefore, if you get our government to work better on those issues, whether it's keeping us safe or ensuring that the food we eat is safe, whatever it might be, then you've created more value than any other intervention you can have. And in order for that to be the case, we have to be concerned about the health of our government. So almost everybody, business, nonprofits, universities, they all engage government around their policy desires, and they usually pay very little attention to the health of the institution. And that's the gap that we focus on. How do we make sure we have very qualified people in the career and political ranks who are equipped to serve the public well? And we do that through focusing on the transition, identifying, you know, innovators in government and recognizing them, you know, providing accountability data. It's a range of different things that we do to try to help the government work better. And interestingly, there really isn't very much any other organization like us doing what we do. And we should see more focus on this, not just from specific organizations, but any organization that cares about our future should be thinking about the government's health.
So on the government's health, then, give our government a physical, if you would. How is the health of our government, and what is the Partnership for Public Service doing about it?
So I would say not so good. When I say that, it's not just the last four years that have been hard in the government. There have been decades, bluntly what I would say, there have been decades of rust. And then the Trump administration came in with a sledgehammer. And when I say that, you know, one of our programs is something called the Best Places to Work rankings. We were able to encourage a law that got passed that requires every agency to conduct an annual employee survey. And our perspective is that in the government, you're not seeking financial returns. You're trying to create public goods, harder to measure. But what employees have to say about what's going on is a very powerful proxy for performance. And if you look at the overall employee engagement across the federal government, it's a good 14 points below what you would see in a private sector analog. Now, the government workforce is higher rating on their mission commitment. They're willing to go the extra mile to get the job done to serve the public. But when it comes to their perspectives on their leadership, on their ability to get the information they need to do their jobs well, on accountability, all those things, it's well below what you would see in a good, in a well-run private organization. So that's a report card of consequence here. It's what the employees themselves have to say, and it's not where it should be. And it's not the only report card that we should be concerned about. If you look at customer experience indices, again, there are some federal agencies that are fantastic, but by and large, the federal government is slipping behind what best-in-class private sector organizations provide. So, you know, whatever your metric, there's absolute room for improvement. It's not to diminish the extraordinary things that government continues to do, but the people in government do it despite their leaders and despite the aging rules and institutions they have to work within. And we just need to modernize them. I mean, the idea that you have this mission-committed workforce, if you gave that workforce the right tools and support, you could achieve so much more.
We're talking with Max Steyer. He is CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. He's talking about what his work involves with an organization that houses the Center for Presidential Transition. Taking your questions on transition at 800-642-1234. Max, you mentioned earlier morale is very low in government work right now. What could build up the morale? What could change your rankings?
So, it goes back to the mission point that I made earlier. It's an amazing asset to have people who are so committed to the mission of what they do, which spans everything. The element that is most important and most missing for the federal workforce are really good leaders. And so you see that in any organization, and leadership matters. In the government, and this comes back to the transition stuff we were talking about earlier, you have these 4,000 political appointees come in. You know, even if they're the best qualified people in terms of, you know, great talent, they're coming in for a short time period, on average 18 months to 2 years. And so one challenge for the federal workforce is you have this huge cohort, many layers of leaders and sort of an entourage that comes with them that are only around for a short period of time, and their focus is on short-term delivery and not on the long-term health of the agencies and therefore not on the workforce. So, you know, one of the first things that can and should be done would be to have an expectation of those political leaders that their priorities, in addition to their policy concerns, must include, you know, helping the organization work better, which inevitably means, you know, creating value in their own workforce, developing them, bringing new talent in. Only 6% of the federal workforce is under the age of 30. It's worth hanging on that one for a little bit. I mean, it's 23% for the general workforce. In organizations like the Partnership, it's, you know, almost 60%. It's not a healthy workforce. It doesn't have the generational diversity it needs. And that's because the leaders aren't paying attention. So, you know, both the political and career leaders need support, development, and accountability on taking care of the workforce.
Max Steyer leads the Partnership for Public Service. It's a nonprofit focused on improving the way government functions. What are you watching for in the transition? What do you think of the cabinet-level picks? Will they be confirmed? Still time to talk. Transition 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Max Steyer here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Max Steyer, president of the nonprofit Partnership for Public Service. Biden's transition is behind schedule. The forthcoming Senate impeachment trial proceedings could push the confirmation process timetable back further. We're discussing what delays could do to this administration that is walking into a raging COVID pandemic with underwhelming vaccine rollout amid an ailing economy and a national security breach. Let's bring in Peter now in Ashland. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thanks for this topic. I don't think this information is out there enough as it is. I am retired federal government 37 years. And what I saw from the political side, this is, I'm thinking back mainly to Reagan, but there were other times that we had it, even under George W. They would starve us for resources in areas where they wanted, like, a contractor or somebody. What would happen is they would make it impossible for us to actually accomplish the job in a timely and good manner. And then they would turn around and say, well, look, we've got to hire a contractor because you guys aren't getting the job done. Outside contractor. Or they would, various different ways they did this. But then, you know, a year or two later, it would turn out that the contractor was costing twice as much as what the government had been costing before they starved it. So then the people that are still there get less things because it has to go to the contractor because the contract's been signed. And so the government employees become less important, even though they're cheaper, and we're doing, in many cases, a better job.
Max, what is your response to what Peter lays out here in this scenario?
So very helpful, and again, a thank you to you for your public service. And it's worthwhile noting that 85% of the federal workforce is outside the D.C. metro area. So a lot of people equate the federal government with Washington, D.C., when in fact the vast bulk of the workforce is across, you know, spread across the entire country. Peter's got this, right. It's a problem. The federal government is often measured in size by the headcount, which I think I may have mentioned earlier is about the same size as it was in the late 1960s, when in fact I think it should be looked at by budget. The budget's not been going down. It's been going up, and there's over $500 billion a year that goes to contractors. And there's nothing wrong with looking for help outside of the federal workforce, so long as the choices are being made on the right basis and the resources are being used well. And unfortunately, as Peter suggests, neither of those are often true. So there is a real work, if we want our government to work better, something that you raised earlier about the federal employee morale, this is a huge issue, really fixing the contracting process, ensuring that the right work is being done by outside supporters, and it's being done in a way that gets, best value for the American public. And it's a broken system. So these are all huge issues with very big consequence. And, ultimately, if you don't have the right talent inside government to manage external resources well, then it won't happen. And so this is, to my mind, if you were giving me a list of five biggest problems, it would certainly be on it in terms of trying to make the government work better.
How lucrative are government bids, government contracts, and the industry for contract government work?
Well, it's huge. As I said, over $500 billion. So it's a lot of money. And part of the challenge, too, is that the process is so convoluted and difficult that many service providers can't get into the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a very, very large percentage of the contracts winds up going to the process of getting the work as opposed to delivering the actual goods or services. So it's an immensely inefficient system with high walls that create, even less competition. Ultimately, it's not good for the contractors either. I mean, often the federal government says, not here's what we're trying to achieve and we need your help to do it, but they say with great specificity, here's what you need to do. And in many instances, that means that you're asking someone to do something with great specificity when in fact it turns out not to be the actual thing that you need, and they can't pivot because they're committed to providing just what you ask for rather than solving the problem that you need to have solved. So that's another element here. It's a very big issue, and back to the transition for the political appointees, they need to understand it. There's so much that's different and difficult in the federal environment that if they don't understand, they'll trip up and they'll run out of time and not get enough done to help the public.
Peter, thank you. Let's bring in Kathy now in Eau Claire. Kathy, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program. I did hear you talk about the large number of appointees, political appointees, and I'm wondering, I have a couple questions. One, is there anything in progress to limit that and put it back in a meritocracy as it should be? Is there any movement to fund government services and equipment, the infrastructure? I think it's been lacking. That's often where budgets are cut, and now we're feeling that with the unemployment systems. Also, is there a way to improve our government image? And I think all these build on that. There's been, seems, a push from the Republican Party to tell people they hate government, government's bad, government's a swamp. I really think it's time that some things, attention be put to the importance and the value of our government and our government employees.
Kathy, thank you. Yeah, so three questions wrapped in there. First, is there a cap on political appointees or efforts to put a cap on this?
So those are fantastic questions. And on the political appointee piece, in 2010, John McCain and Russ Feingold, someone who undoubtedly
we know
well, exactly, proposed legislation to cut the number of political appointees in half, and that and estimated that would save $800 million over 10 years. And that's the last, I would say, real legislative effort to reduce the number of political appointees. The partnership believes strongly that, you know, we will increase the effectiveness of government and save money if we do it. So this is something we're pursuing, both reducing the overall number of political appointees and also the number that have to go through the Senate confirmation process. On your second question, in terms of investing in the infrastructure of government, it needs to happen, and it hasn't happened. And to real cost. I mean, our government is behind in technology, and some of that is just the access to the technology. A lot of it's having the people in place who understand the value of it. But we really do need to see that investment if we're going to see a big return. The IRS is a perfect example of this. There's literally hundreds of billions of dollars every year that's lost. So our government would actually generate more money by ensuring that everyone is paying their taxes if you improve their technology. And the third piece, absolutely, we need to change the public's understanding of its workforce. And again, come back to Tony Fauci as the best poster child for this. We have a program called the Service to America Medals where we try to identify great civil servants. Please nominate anyone if you have any examples of someone you think is fantastic. But, you know, ultimately it's our government. And if we treat it poorly, we all get hurt.
We only have about 30 seconds left. Wondering, you know, as these new employees go into their government roles, a lot of times the outgoing administration puts together thick binders of information. Will there be binders to walk into?
Definitely binders. And you'll also have even better than that, you know, the career workforce there who will be ready and willing, as they always are. They were when President Trump came in, too, to help. So there's a lot of information. The real question is, do they listen and do they create an environment in which people are going to come to them with bad news? I mean, that's one of the most important leadership issues, is to get people to trust you to bring problems to them.
Max, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, and take good care, and enjoy the inauguration day.
Max Steyer, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Partnership for Public Service. It's a nonprofit group that houses a Center for Presidential Transition. Stay with us throughout the morning. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will soon be sworn in as the next president and vice president of the U.S. Join us for live NPR coverage from the U.S. Capitol starting at 10. That's live inauguration coverage coming your way at 10 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.